Okay, ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Soleri Report. Today is August 3rd, Tuesday. We're recording a day early, and we're going to publish on August 4th, a day early, because we've got a whole media team coming to Stavoren, where I'm located. And so we decided to record early and get this up early. And John Titus, welcome to the Money and Markets. We have so much to talk about.
Right, because 2 weeks have gone by since the last time
we
did this.
Right, and what's our theme?
The theme is the coup has no clothes.
Yep, the gloves are off.
Yeah, everybody sees, well, let's back up. Between last recording and now, Catherine and I both, but mostly Catherine, participated in a Doctors for COVID Ethics Symposium online hosted by UK Column. That was basically 5 million reasons you don't want to stick get jabbed with a pharmaceutical product in your arm. But we did that. And I lost my train of thought.
Well, here's what happened, because we had, and I just have to say, if you haven't seen it, you can link from Soleri or UK Column News. The edited versions are now up as of just not that many hours ago. But John Titus, in 20 minutes, explained how central banking works. It was amazing. But what we had was, we had lawyers, we had doctors, we had scientists, we had finance people, we had lawyers, and everybody coming from the same direction was basically saying, you know, we don't have a health problem, we don't have an economics problem, we don't have a problem that can be solved by the courts. What we have is we have tyranny. This is a coup. And it was amazing, John, because people coming from every different direction were saying, this is a coup. This is not a pandemic. And you made a beautiful comment in the sort of discussion after your presentation. And you said, you know, the rule of law is out the window, and that's a very big problem.
Well, that's what a coup is.
Right.
In the U.S. and in the Western world, you know, all the foundational legal documents, the Declaration of Independence and the U.S. Constitution, but regardless of where it is in the U.S. or not, the law is supposed to be supreme.
Right.
And your only other choice in that regard is man. So if you have people who are above the law, and that is just the way it is, and they tell you we're above the law, they're your rulers, that means there has been a coup.
Right.
Because people can't be above the law in a system that observes the rule of law.
And what the scientists and doctors were able to document is, you know, whatever their excuse, the medical excuse doesn't work. It's all a bunch of buck. Right.
Right. Right.
Right.
Yeah, that's exactly
anyway,
right.
Anyway, so the coup is on and the gloves are off. And I think people around the world are beginning to realize that the 2 weeks to flatten the curve was just a ruse.
Right. Exactly.
Right.
And you have been saying there's been a coup since the early 2000s.
I've been saying it since 1999.
Okay.
Right.
I knew in 2008 that something had happened. I wasn't willing to say it was a coup. By 2013, I'm like, there's definitely been a coup.
Well,
and we're going to touch on that today.
Right. The reason I started saying it in 99 is, if you can completely, if you can take as much money as you want out the back door with no accountability, then it's a matter of time before the government fails. So I called it a financial coup d'etat, but it was systemically a fait accompli that the government would have to be changed if you were going to do that. So that's why I was... Anyway, okay, so let's dive in. Farmageddon,
very first story. This is a very alarming story. DOJ declines to investigate Cuomo's handling of COVID-19 in nursing homes. And I'm just going to scroll down and just read this, and then we talk about it. Justice Department Civil Rights Division had requested information on nursing facilities run by or for the state of New York last August. Okay, so the DOJ says, hey, we need some information. After review, the department declined to open an investigation into any public nursing facility in the state based on violations of civil rights. And so what they're saying there is the DOJ has just allowed New York and other state nursing homes to investigate themselves.
Right.
And that, so they're not going to launch an It's not that they're not going to prosecute. They're not going to investigate. They're just saying, hey, you know what, you nursing homes, you guys just go ahead, you investigate yourselves.
So what they're saying is those policies are essentially state condoned.
Yes, that's exactly right. So whatever happened in those nursing homes is official policy. And the reason I bring that up is that is the, it's the first time I've ever seen since 2013 when Frontline did a special called The Untouchables, where we learned, you know, Martin Smith asked the head of the criminal division in the DOJ, you know, our sources tell us that when it came to Wall Street in the wake of the financial crisis, there were no subpoenas going on. There were no document reviews. There were no wiretaps. And the DOJ says basically, yeah, that's right. So in other words, the DOJ, it wasn't that the DOJ wasn't prosecuting Wall Street for fraud. It was, they weren't investigating Wall Street.
Right.
And now we're seeing that again in this story here.
Right.
So yes, it is official state policy for the for nursing homes to do whatever they did during COVID, just as it was official policy for Wall Street to perpetrate fraud and perpetrate mortgage frauds back in the lead up to the global financial crisis.
Right.
Very bad development.
So what's not clear to me, if this means the Department of Justice is going to do no investigations whatsoever, then the civil cases, I'm assuming, are free to move forward. And you have 15,000 plus families, I'm assuming, who may want to bring lawsuits. And that means depositions. That means disclosure. That means discovery.
Right.
You know, vis-a-vis Cuomo, I would think.
Right. But the problem is, though, Catherine, when you get an official, what's called a declination,
right,
like this, where the DOJ says, no, we're not going to do it, that sets the tone.
Right. And the
that,
judges,
that signals.
Right. The judges will pay great attention. And that means the cost and expense of what the families want to do that much greater. They've got a much higher target.
Your hurdle is a lot higher because now the nursing homes are going to, they're picking up on this Q2. They're going to dig their heels in during discovery. They're not going to give you depositions. They're going to be very reluctant to turn over documents because they know that the judges are seeing what the nursing homes are seeing, which is the tone has been set from on high.
Right. And this also means if you look at all the different principles internationally of human rights and law, this means that the U.S. as a federal governmental matter is now seriously in violation of those principles.
Right. It gets back to there's no rule of law.
Right.
When you have alleged criminals investigating themselves, that those people are above the law.
Right.
That's what the DOJ is saying. And that's what the DOJ is a position they have maintained
right.
with respect to banks since 2013. It didn't matter who was in office. The DOJ was not investigating Wall Street banks,
so,
period, full stop.
So this is why this is relevant to everyone listening. If you go back, the reason I split with the establishment had a lot to do with my objection to their basically rounding up innocent kids and throwing them into prison. And, you know, what was underway with the sort of private prison wave, I described as essentially genocide and slave labor camps. And I said, if we allow this to be done to any American, it's just a matter of time until it can be done to us. And
right.
I think what you're saying is, you know, first it was the bankers who are above the law. Now it's Cuomo and the nursing homes that are above the law. And the reality is when you have no law, then it's a matter of time before that lawlessness comes. And whether it takes your assets or it takes your life or it injects you with poison, you know, it if it can be done to any, it can be done to all. And this
it's going to be done to you eventually. It's like
right.
the poem during World War II. First they came for the gypsies and then they came for the, you know, the Jews. And by the time, you know, but I wasn't a gypsy, I wasn't a Jew. Then they came for me and
right.
there's no one around.
Right. And so in 1998, I thought that we were exactly in that spot. And I was shocked to find that most other people didn't see it. But I think now we can see it.
Right.
So I'm hoping that everyone will understand there's no, You know, the line has been drawn and you're on one side or the other. C.J. Hopkins just wrote a great article called The Road to Totalitarianism. And he said, the line's been drawn. You have to pick sides. What side are you on? And if you, you don't want to be a slave, you're going to have to, you're going to have to pick. You're going to have to pick freedom.
Yeah, you're going to have to be on the right side of history.
Right.
And I tell people, listen, you know, most critical points in history, when it matters, in clutch situation, most people are on the wrong side of history.
Right.
Most colonists wanted to stay with England. Most Germans didn't oppose the Nazis. Most Americans, including shamefully myself, were all for the, you know, the war in Iraq based on weapons of mass destruction.
Right.
You know, being on the wrong side of history, most people are on the wrong side of history, period.
Well, now we have an opportunity to get on the right side.
Right. Now's your chance.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. The president's not going to help you. I'm looking at the second story.
Like I tell people, you're not voting your way out of this.
Right.
Don't forget that. Okay, let's move on. More Farmageddon. This is really a 1-2 punch here. Biden, on-site contractors. So contractors must be vaccinated, basically. They have to attest a vaccine status or be subject to restrictions. He announced that all federal employees and on-site contractors will be asked to attest their vaccine status.
Right.
And if they do not attest to being fully vaccinated, then they will have to wear a mask and a yellow star, regardless of their location, social distance from others at work, more yellow star, two yellow stars, and comply with weekly or twice weekly coronavirus testing for the triple yellow star and be limited on official travel. So that's actually, it says here, if you look, federal employees and on-site contractors. So it's both permanent employees and contractors for the federal government.
Right.
They're affected by this. There's another story from the Journal. You know, he's requiring COVID-19 vaccine and regular tests for federal workers, but that's what we just saw.
Right.
So the policy has been set now.
Right.
You know, the government is going to do everything they can to require just people within their ambit, federal workers and federal contractors, to be vaccinated. And they're leaving it up to the private sector to be the muscle to get people who do not fit that description to get vaccinated.
And the pressure behind the scenes is enormous.
Oh, it's got to be.
Right.
Got to be. I don't know where it's coming from, but I'm not sure it matters. All right, moving on. This is a story from Solari Report.
Actually, it's from Doctors for COVID Ethics. We just published an introduction to it. And we've been waiting for Bhakti and Palmer, two of the lead scientists and MDs behind Doctors for COVID Ethics, to come out with this piece. And it's about the toxicity, you know, and I defer to the piece, but if you look at the spike protein tearing vascular walls and then materials getting out into the body, going into the lymph glands and then going to different organs. And one of them that that the doctors are very concerned about, John, is the toxicity that goes into the ovaries. And the real question here is there what is the danger that this causes infertility in women, given the toxicity that goes to the ovaries? So, and of course, they went through that on the second day on the Doctors for COVID Ethics. But this has taken, you know, you have a group of very brave, courageous scientists who've been working on this for months, trying to figure out, you know, sort of what this will do to the human body. And the we had a disclosure from the Japanese agency and information that Pfizer had the Japanese had forced disclosure to them and the U.S. hadn't provided it. So it's shocking that we should have to go to Japan to get this information, and it's shocking what the information may indicate. So I would just defer to the article, but you know, there's a lot about these injections we don't know, but this group and various groups around the world have really worked hard to at least figure out what we do know. And now there's more.
Yeah. And they raised this right in the article. The second kind of bullet point there, grave harm to female fertility. You can expect that. You can also expect the first bullet, blood clotting shortly after vaccination, potentially leading to heart attack, stroke, and venous thrombosis, and then maybe cumulative toxicity after multiple injections. So it's a host of right. maladies you can expect. And this is according to Doctors Bhakti and Palmer.
Right.
Yeah. So, and by the way, as to female fertility, I will mention this, even though I didn't provide an article on it. Evidently has been a ton of research in fertility in pets, female fertility in pets for a long time before the COVID-19 pandemic hit. And I bring that up because, you and I kind of wondered, like, why is Albert Bourla, the head criminal at Pfizer, a veterinarian, wonder why they picked a vet? So anyway, I'll send that article to you. It's interesting.
Okay.
Continuing on, this gets to what you can do. This is disclosure forms. I'm going to talk about this.
Yeah. So last week we were able, by Friday night when the Doctors for COVID Ethics Forum began, to publish revised forms for employee and schools. So these forms, John, are designed for you to sit down with a school official and sit down with an employer and walk them through the informed consent process, not just on health, but on financial, and force them to do informed consent. And I defy any school or employer to do this. And one of the reasons we have these forms is I don't think that the employers and schools understand the manufacturers are free of liability, and the government
right.
may think it's free of liability, but they are not free of liability, particularly with respect to informed consent. And I dare say I struggle to see how a school or employer could require this and meet informed consent. But those forms are designed to do that. And my anecdotal information is people have been able to back up the process by using them. I should also mention we have a parental consent form, and we also are in the process of redoing the family financial disclosure form, which helps different members within a family hold each other accountable, particularly for the financial risks of getting an injection. And if you come into Solari on the homepage, we have a little banner right underneath the top that says COVID resources and forms. And if you click on that, you can access all those forms. And believe it or not, the employer and student form, which of course is entirely free, this is a public, this is for everybody. If you are in a different jurisdiction or you want to change it or adapt it, I encourage you there's no copyright, just take it, use it, adapt it, translate it, whatever you can do to make it more useful or helpful for you, please do it. We're just trying to essentially save as many lives and families as possible. So, absolutely spread it. But interestingly enough, yesterday, the employee and student form became the number one best hit getter at Solari.
Wow.
I know.
That's great.
Yeah, it is.
That's
great.
That's super.
Now, we flush the statistics regularly, so we're not going back to the beginning of time. But yeah. I would say people are using this and it's helping. So
That's great.
It is great. It's great.
Yeah. So you don't need to be a subscriber to get to these forms, obviously.
No, these are absolutely for everybody. Yeah. Pass them on, send them on, redo them. Whatever you can do to take this and make it better and help people, that's what we want to do.
Yeah. Wow. That's great. Okay. Moving on, let's go to this symposium.
It's great.
Yeah, it was 2 days. It was last Thursday and last Friday. And the session one, The False Pandemic. So this was Professor Martin Hadich and, Bhakti, Palmer, a lot of names I'd seen before. Anything to add about session one?
We had a lot of there were technical glitches. Sutrat gave a great opening speech, and then we had a lot of technical difficulties, and this has been edited out. One of my favorite parts of the whole conference, starting with one, is Mike Yaden is the Pfizer scientist who's been so clear and outspoken about the dangers of the injections and the clear indication, whatever the injections are, it has nothing to do with SARS-CoV-2. And he's so credible. And then we also had Thomas Binder, and who's a wonderful cardiologist from Switzerland, and then Charles Huff, who's a family practitioner from British Columbia. And Binder and Huff are in the tradition of those great doctors who love their patients and have decades of experience caring for their patients, you know, and they just ooze integrity. And so I think the highlights for day one for me was Yaden, Binder, Huff, and then, of course, Dennis Rancourt gave some great sort of statistics and sort of epidemiology about what's really going on. So there was a lot of good stuff, but I would, if you're busy, and I know you are, I would focus on watching the two doctors and then Yaden.
Yeah. And these videos, by the way, they're available on Rumble.
If you go to UK Column News, they're all there, okay. But we also link from Solari, so you can find them on Solari or UK Column News, and they're all free, open, pass them around. This was entirely public. It's a public forum.
Right, completely public. And you can see that if you go to Rumble and look at the viewership numbers. Day one is well over 200,000 views.
That's amazing on Rumble. That's amazing.
Yes. Yeah. Right, Rumble.
Yeah.
Right, this isn't YouTube.
Right.
This is Rumble.
Right.
And it's like 220,000 views now. And day two is something like 130,000 views, well over 100,000. It's amazing, the numbers, the interest this symposium generated.
So here's why I'm so pleased with this. And I heard this from many different people who emailed and commented afterwards. The quality of the people was so extraordinary. And I think we're all so tired of seeing either politicians or being blackmailed or scared or doctors who are brainwashed. To have this many brilliant scientists and doctors and other related people who truly care about what's in the best interests of everyone, and seeing that many high quality people again and again and again, you know, it was like finding an oasis in the desert and taking a nice refreshing bath.
Speaking of brilliant, one person who was there is not a doctor. At least not of medicine. Professor Richard Verner participated in some of the panels.
Right. So my idea of how to learn about central banking is to listen to you and Richard. And the idea of having you together in one group was really wonderful. It's like, okay, here we go.
Because I had actually made a video of one of Verner's papers in which he proves that commercial banks create money out of nothing when they lend. Brilliant paper.
It is.
Let's look back. So that's day one. There's also a second day. Any highlights you want to?
Well, the second session on the first day.
This is the second session
on the first day.
Right.
And that was the going direct reset. And that's where the organizers referred to you guys as the dream team. We had Titus Werner, Mark Skidmore, and Patrick Wood. And it was... you know, this was first we had the scientists saying it ain't a pandemic, and then we had the economics saying, you know, it's basically a takedown. This is not a problem with the economy. It's not a collapse. It's not a failure. This is a takedown.
Absolutely a takedown, for
sure. Right.
I'm working on a video now that's going to prove that beyond any shadow of a doubt. Okay. Continuing on. Oh, wait a minute. We are shifting gears.
Well, we have to go to the second day. So the third session is...
Except I don't have...
just published it after you did this. So just go to UK Column News, or, you know, you can link from Solari. We have it up in a commentary. And you can get the two sessions on the second day. And that's where they deep dive the injections. And Palmer and Yaden are fantastic. And I just can't recommend Mike Yaden on the second day enough. And then we had the fourth session. We had the journalists show up and the lawyers show up, and it was called the Hour of Justice. Vera Sharev came in, who I just adore. And she's the one who, you know, she as a child survived World War II and the whole German stuff and the camps. And she got on and said, You know, I never thought I would see this again, but here they are again. It was great. Yeah.
Wow. That's very powerful because I kind of joked earlier about yellow stars in connection with COVID vaccinations and identifying yourself. But the parallels with Nazi Germany really at this point are too hard to, they're
right.
almost impossible to ignore.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Well, I just saw an email from somebody in Israel who's been fighting the ejections there. And she posted on Telegram, we're in a ghetto. And she described all the rules that are being applied to the unvaccinated. And it's like the Warsaw ghetto.
Yeah.
Right.
It's incredible.
Right.
And people just have their heads in the sand. Like, oh, that would never happen here.
I don't think people have their head. I'm seeing pushback everywhere.
So, oh, yeah.
Yeah.
And we're gonna get to some of that pushback. Right. First, however, we need to talk about diluting the brand because there is most certainly some of that. So let's take a look at there's only two this week on diluting the brand. First is from the AMA. Lobbying to have sex removed from birth certificate.
Would you go to a doctor who wanted this?
Unbelievable. No. Absolutely.
You know, I hate to say this. My father was a very famous surgeon, as you know, and he used to refer to these guys as those sons of a bitches.
Yeah. So in June, the Board of Trustees report AMA resolved to lobby the U.S. government to remove the sex of a child from their birth certificate.
So to me, this is proof positive that they're using physical coercion.
Listen to this nonsense from them.
Okay.
Requiring it on the birth certificate, according to the AMA, according to this report, can lead to discrimination and unnecessary burden on individuals whose current gender identity does not align with their designation at birth. Does that sound like medicine to you, or does that sound?
That sounds like physical coercion to me.
that's crazy. Okay, the second one I've got in. And diluting the brand it's arguably diluting the brand. It really has to do with optimism in the U.S.
Right.
And I'm just going to get into this, and I'm gonna go old school on the sound now, just so you can hear it. This is a clip about an optimism poll in the U.S. Now, one of the things I learned from doing the symposium online is that running it out of your speakers is fine. The sound, you know, it works that way. So give me a second. I'll plug my headphones, and now we're going to run this clip. Here we go.
I do want to turn to another topic, though. Our new ABC News Ipsos poll out this morning, it shows a significant drop in optimism about the direction of our country over the next year. Take a look here. Only 45% of those polled are optimistic. That's down 19 points from May when it was 64%. Rick, what are the key factors behind all of this?
Yeah, what really striking, crime and fears around gun violence are a piece of this, as are things like immigration, inflation, and critically, the pandemic. We saw in this poll President Biden's approval rating on handling of COVID down 9 points just since April. The country is in a much different place than it was just a few months ago, and President Biden and the Democrats should see that as blaring warning signs. These things are changing, and they are changing fast in a whole lot of different directions.
But it also shows that most Americans are pessimistic about the year ahead.
Okay, so what do you make of all that? I mean, I think that the plunging optimism to me is really the media is just stoking up fears of Delta, 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 and that's what people know there's another round of lockdowns coming. That to me is very clear about where the pessimism is coming from.
So I think it's becoming progressively more clear as lies compound that everything you're being told by the government and the media is a lie. And and the question is, it creates this sense of enormous incoherence. And the question is, what are you going to do about it? And people are not sure what they're going to do about it, but they know it means nothing good. So I just think there is... So, for example, we saw Cuomo come out and say, you needed to wear, I think it was something about masks indoor, and then California came out and said, yes, masks indoor. And the nature of the incoherence and the contradictions are so great. It's like Fauci saying, masks don't work, then the next day you have to wear a mask, then the next day you have to wear two masks, so So it's this incoherence that is making them extremely uncomfortable. And I think it comes back to your point, John. If there's no rule of law, then we're in a world that's the rule of man. And I don't, most Americans and most, you know, most people, citizens in the G7, know that that can only lead to a collapse of civilization.
Yeah. Even if people don't kind of think that through, I think a lot of people intuitively know that a system that's run by people who lie willy-nilly is not a system that's good for them.
Right. I think one of the reasons the Doctors for COVID Ethics was so successful is just watching excellent people is very inspiring. Yep. And I think people feel the need for that. It's every time I watch the Sir James Goldsmith on globalization, I think, wow, imagine a world where that guy was your president. Wow.
Right.
Right.
And the other thing is that the people on the symposium, the Doctors for COVID Ethics, it's not just that they come from, they have great pedigrees. They do. They're super educated. They have all the certificates and licenses and awards and all that. But it's that what they're saying makes sense. And you think in the media, you just have someone who has, they have the resume, but then they're just going to tell you a bunch of lies.
So I used to have a professor of management at Wharton who would say this again and again. He would say, they understand what must and what should not be.
Yeah.
So they understand the line between lawful and lawless. They understand the line between civilization and the absence of civilization. They see those lines, and that's, they communicate that, that sense of caring that those lines are drawn and kept.
Right.
Right.
Right. So especially somebody like Bhakti. You know, he's got that moral gravitas to him, and really an emotional gravitas to him. Like, he really cares about what's going on.
Right.
And it's physically hurting him to see this happen.
Right.
And see his fellow doctors harming people.
Right.
You know, that's like inflicting physical pain.
Right.
On that guy.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, it's inconceivable to these doctors that this could ever happen.
Right, it is.
Right.
That comes across very clearly. And I think people, they pick up on that and respond to that. Whereas you see these TV doctors like Fauci. I mean, does anybody really think Fauci cares about any patients? Has he even had any patients ever? No.
I just think Fauci is a professional desk killer.
Right.
Right.
It's very obvious. And the contrast between somebody like Palmer and Bhakti on the one hand and Fauci on the other could not be any more stark.
Right.
No.
Kennedy spoke on the second day. We ran one of his a speech he did to the people who were at the protests, and he's coming out with a book on Fauci. I've got it on pre-order, and it's going to be a doozy.
Huh. When you say Kennedy, you mean obviously Robert F. Kennedy Jr.
Right. Correct.
Right.
Right.
Yeah, the Children's Health Defense Fund.
Right.
Yeah. Okay. Let's change gears to FedWatch. Okay. And this first story, I actually would kind of reconsider. I would almost put this in CBDC. This is about the Social Security Administration backlog delaying eligibility and card processing, according to a study. And right here in the first paragraph, backlog at Social Security processing centers, which is allegedly caused by the pandemic, meaning some claimants and beneficiaries have yet to receive key documentation from the program. Okay, so then they get into some interesting numbers here. One facility had more than 9,000 unprocessed documents dating back to November of 2020. So that's actually not that far, because by November 2020, we're a good 8 months into the pandemic.
Right.
Right? Okay.
But here's the thing. If you're dependent on Social Security and, you know, 2 weeks is a lifetime to wait.
Yeah, that's a long time without food, isn't it?
Right.
Another facility had 200,000 pieces of returned, unprocessed mail, which the report noted could require action like suspending or terminating benefits. Okay, and here's where it really gets interesting, this story. The Social Security Administration is not the only government agency that's running behind. And they give an example of the IRS. The IRS is facing a backlog of 35.3 million unprocessed individual and business returns, which is a fourfold increase over its backlog in 2019. In other words, they were in a bad spot to begin with. Now it's 35 million.
So that, wow, that may mean that people aren't getting their refunds.
It could mean a lot of things. To me, it means they kind of given up. Dude, you're never going to get through 35 million ever. And the need for going digital is every day that goes by,
right,
is it enhances the need for the criminals and the people who want to control this to go digital.
Well, it's not just go digital, but go digital in a way that's controlled by private contractors and banks.
Right.
Right.
And we're going to see that in a couple more stories in conjunction.
Well, remember also, many times in the federal government, not all the time, but many times when you see stories like this, this is intentional. In other words, the operational problems are the excuse for something that is being designed to slow down the cash flows.
Right.
So.
Right. Yeah.
So you're looking at either politics or a budgeting move, you know, and sometimes it's operational, but rarely. If they want to fix an operational problem, they have the resources, particularly with FASB 56, to jump in right away.
Right. And that's exactly why I say the fact that it's pushing people, denying them benefits and whatever, it's pushing them toward a UBI system.
Exactly.
It's providing the cover for the government to step in and say, oh, you know what? Yeah, we need a solution to this, and the solution is universal basic income and central bank digital currency.
Right. Although what, right, I don't know is, and you know, I would need a community wizard kind of tool to tell, but what you don't know is to what extent, in combination with other things going on, that's part of the kind of genocide we saw in the nursing homes.
Yes, right. And we're going to see in the very next story, might as well just get right to it, another tendency here to push people to the edge, and that's this. Welcome to the Great Reset. Corporate landlords poised to snatch Americans' property after eviction moratorium expires. And so the backstory here is Democrats left Washington for the recess without extending an eviction moratorium, which was set to, and indeed did, expire on Saturday. The 11-month moratorium prevented millions of Americans losing their homes. It expired on June 31st. And that moratorium was put in place by Trump last year.
Didn't it end on July 31st?
Yeah, July. Did I say June?
Yeah, I thought you said June. July 31st.
Okay, July 31st. The moratorium was put in place by Trump administration last year and extended by Biden. But the Supreme Court has ruled very recently that a further extension would require, quote, clear and specific congressional authorization, which authorization, the story tells us, did not come, because they left the Congress left for the recess before doing anything. House Democrats had enough votes for extending the moratorium, but didn't. And House Speaker Nancy Pelosi put the failure down to not having enough time to socialize it within our caucus, as well as to build consensus, especially in a time of COVID. So that's her excuse for not doing anything. And now we get into some numbers. Moody's estimate, and I'm going to tell you right now, this estimate is way low.
Uh-huh.
Moody's estimates that 6 million tenants are in arrears, while more than 3.5 million people told the U.S. Census Bureau in early July that they could face eviction in 2 months. So that's renters. And the article points out the moratorium could also apply to homeowners facing foreclosure, and there's 2 million of them. So you have a total here, according to this estimate, of at least 8 million people who are facing eviction or foreclosure. They're going to be dispossessed of their homes.
Right. And one part of this, which I'm not sure about, but there is a lot of indications that the feds had given the states money for the landlords to prevent these kind of numbers of evictions, and some states have sat on the money.
Right. And the other problem is a lot of landlords, according to official stories, didn't apply for the relief.
Right. So this is going to You know, if you're a landlord and you have particularly rent-controlled areas, I'm assuming like New York, this is going to give you an opportunity to clear out a lot of people. And my understanding, John, is that when the moratorium comes off, I don't just owe my rent next month. I owe the rent all the way back to the beginning.
That's
so
correct.
Most yeah. people have probably dug themselves into an enormous hole. Now, you and I both know, I've said many, many times, I think the way everybody's going to make money on the smart grid is through the real estate. So there have been tremendous efforts since the Going Direct Reset started to set up a lot of big investors to buy real estate.
Right.
And this is going to give them a free, you know, this is going to give them an incredible opportunity.
Yep. And we're going to see that. I'm going to turn back to the story in a second. But first, I want to say these estimates of 8 million people, I think they're way low.
Right.
There was an article by a guy named Mish Shedlock. I think if you just search M-I-S-H, Mish, you'll find him pretty quickly. And he says the numbers are more like, it's basically double these numbers.
Yes.
And I put way more stock in what he says. He's pretty careful with his numbers. And in fact, he actually called people in the government and got sort of independent verification that his methodology, Mish's methodology leading to the double of estimates here, it was correct.
I'm with you. If Mish says it's double, I would.
Yeah, it's at least double. He's right. Careful. Yeah. So got back to the story. So you got 16 million people, maybe 20 million people teetering on the brink. Who's going to mop up? Here you go. Staggeringly wealthy pension funds such as BlackRock and Blackstone have spent the pandemic buying up homes, often at well over market value, with a view to renting them out to the same Americans now priced out of the market. Okay, the eviction moratorium was a double-edged sword in some cases, with small-time mom-and-pop landlords unable to collect rent from their tenants facing no choice but to sell to BlackRock and its ilk. And so that's who's mopping up here.
Right. It was very interesting. I can't tell you how many people, when I would talk to them about how are you going to make it through, or how are your friends going to make it through, or how are you going to family make it through, invariably, three quarters of the time, the response was, we're going to sell our house.
Yeah.
Right.
Right. Right. So the big, you know, the rich are getting richer. You know, this whole lockdown, it's just crushing the middle class on down. And it's just enriching the top 0.01%.
Well, it's disaster capitalism. It's not a lockdown.
Yeah.
You know, BlackRock didn't lock down. They had plenty of money to spend. They were on a shopping spree.
Right.
Right.
Yeah. Next story in FedWatch. This is not out of the U.S., so technically it's not the Fed. But there's enough similarities with the Fed. You could tell where this is coming from. Abolition of certificates of title. This is out of New South Wales in Australia. Changes to the land title system. They're transitioning away from paper-based processes, which is how land is done in the West, is paper. Existing certificates of title will be canceled, and new certificates of title will no longer be issued. And then they go on, lodging and land dealings in paper will not be permitted starting October 11th, 2021. All land dealings to be lodged with New South Wales can be done electronically. So there you have it.
Right. So this will make securitization fraud much easier to happen, is my guess, based on what happened in the United States. But it's also going to make seizures much faster, much easier.
Yes. Electronic. Do things fast.
Right.
Foreclosed very quickly, but again, it's getting to let's make things that make everything digital.
Right,
and the story reminds you, I'm sure it reminds me of MERS in the U.S.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the electronic registry, and who did that? That was the very same law firm that failed to prosecute Wall Street banks of Lanny Breuer, Eric Holder. That was Covington and Burling.
Right,
that was centrally involved in MERS.
Right.
So again, this New South Wales story. Yeah, it's New South Wales. But the fingerprints from the American criminals and from the financial criminals are all over that story.
Right. It's right? very concerning. If I had big positions in Australian real estate, I'd be worried.
Yeah.
Right.
Right. I'd be a little concerned in the U.S. too. Because Australia is sort of like that. That's where they're doing some beta testing before they do the rollout in the U.S.
Right.
Okay, next story. I've got this in reader view. I'm going to get that out of reader view. Investors overseeing $14 trillion, they're going to call. They call for a vote on company climate plans. So let's just get into this. They say investors managing $14 trillion in assets. Now, I'll tell you right up front, BlackRock manages $9 trillion, so they're not in this group, interestingly enough.
Uh-huh.
Okay, so investors managing $14 trillion in assets said they want all companies to set a climate transition plan and allow them to vote on it. Meaning the investors to vote on it ahead of next year's season for annual meetings. 53 investors, including UBS Asset Management. They're actually UBS is number three in terms of assets under management globally. So that's who's really spearheading this. And they say currently around a fifth of the world's 2,000 largest companies have a climate plan, these investors say. So the other 80% don't. So what are they proposing here, this asset management group? They're using their muscle. Here's what they want. Companies need to identify which board directors, in addition to the chair, would lead the efforts and be the focal point for engagement by investors, and who would be voted against if the plan was considered inadequate. Okay, so you got that? So you get on board with this climate plan, or we're going to kick out the head of your climate guy,
uh-huh.
whoever that, your climate, we're going to kick out the CEO too, or the head of the board of directors.
Right.
Right? So they're not playing around here. And the investors also say we're applicable with local law. They wanted companies to provide an advisory vote on the plan's implementation. So you better get on board to let us vote on this. And if you don't do it, investors could look to express their opinion by voting on other resolution, such as re-election of board members.
Right. And their goal has nothing to do with climate change. Their goal has to do with making sure the top 1% control all the resources and can tell everybody what to do. And so the shareholders no longer control. It's institutional money. You know, it's the FASB 56 guys working through institutional proxy control.
Yeah.
And if there's anything you want to do, if you want to stop tyranny, take all your money out of institutional control. Take it back into family control. You know, 100 years ago, all of the family wealth in the world was under family control, and it needs to go back to family control.
Right. At this point, if you have a company and it's a closely held company, privately held company, you'd have to be insane to do an IPO.
Right.
And put it out for these wolves to take over. And look what they're doing.
So I wanted to recommend, there's a wonderful book I reviewed several years ago called Killing Sustainability. And it was by an engineer type who was really interested in helping companies become more environmentally responsible, which I think is a good thing. And so this guy started off being, helping companies do that. And he finally got to the point where he said, you know, the whole sustainability push is a bunch of bunk. And if you want your company to be more environmentally responsible, here's how you do it. And it's an interesting book that navigates between what was initially meant by a lot of good natured people to be a great thing and the weaponization of this stuff.
Yeah. That story, by the way, that we just saw about these climate plans and whatnot, that's perfectly in line with the theme. The coup has no clothes. The gloves are off.
Right.
I mean, this is right out in the open. They're saying, you better get on board this climate plan. We're going to vote you out. We'll take over your company.
Right. This is a free takeover. Doesn't cost you any money. Right.
Yeah.
But
unbelievable.
But it can work. I'll tell you why it can work, John. It can work because we have not brought transparency to how the control system works and the control files work. And that's why I love the Doctors for COVID Ethics Symposium, because that was a real effort to show you how they're weaponizing all these different things and what it's going to take for us to push back. And I'm glad we brought up this $14 trillion story because, you know, we got to stop letting these guys manage our money.
Yeah. Yeah, they have your money. They have control.
Right. Right. And they're using
control.
They're using control of your retirement savings or your bank deposits to destroy your world.
Yeah. Do you really put it past these criminals if they want to control all this stuff to control what you think and to penalize you for thinking the wrong thoughts?
Right. Right.
Of course, if they could, they would. Of course they would.
Well, but you have no idea how many people I run into who are still banking at the New York Fed member banks. And yeah, I say to them, why do you trust them with your money? And they say, well, my account's small. I'm not important. Wrong.
You're wrong.
You're very important.
Yeah. When you move that money out, that's a pain to those banks.
Yep.
You know?
Yep. So
yeah, get out of those banks.
I'm with you.
Yeah. Okay. Moving on to, CBDC. This story is just unbelievable. Just the way it's framed. It's just silly. Okay. A Fed issued digital dollar could print money for the people. Do you remember Mighty Mouse? Remember that?
Yes,
that
I love Mighty Mouse.
Okay, Mighty Mouse. Here he comes to save the day. Okay, the CBDC is Mighty Mouse in this story.
I love this one. This is the biggest lie yet. It's incredible.
This is so ridiculous. More and more informed observers are asking why, after 13-plus years of Federal Reserve's increasingly aggressive monetary interventions, the benefits remain so skewed toward Wall Street over Main Street. Because that's the point. Do you think maybe that has something to do with it? The answer is simple. Follow the money. You know, the Fed's just pumping the money to Wall Street, and that's just basically what they do. The Fed can't control where the money goes or who the financial institutions. The Fed only picks the people they're transacting with. So how could they control the money to where it goes when they're only picking the parties from whom they're going to buy assets? What a crazy thing. So the answer to all this, to enriching Wall Street, fortunately, here we go. Here's Mighty Mouse. Here he comes. New technology in the form of a central bank digital currency provides a mechanism for the Fed to distribute cash directly to working families. Here he comes to save the day. Central bank digital currency.
When I saw this one, and I think I sent it to you, right? I couldn't.
Yeah.
I was just like, you are not ready for the... Every time
you have to be kidding me.
Every time I think they can't come up with an even bigger lie, it's kind of like, here it is. We have a new thing. You're going to love it. It's 3 square meals a day. It's called a prison.
Yeah.
You won't have to do the cleaning. Somebody will clean for you.
Gaslighting is out of control.
Yep.
Like they don't mention, oh, well, they're going to control what you could buy. You can't have a double cheeseburger, you. Your social credit score isn't high enough.
So, so it's gotten to the point where some of the people, you know, I don't own a TV and I don't watch TV, but occasionally I'll see some of the internet things of the news, and they can't even say it with a straight face anymore. Even they are laughing as they say it. So, you know it's bad.
Okay. The next story, I love this next story from the American Institute for Economic Research. Will cash soon be obsolete? And the story kind of starts off with the bogeyman. China, according to many people, China is causing us to worry that the U.S. may be falling behind. So that's sort of the first trope for CBDC. Like, we got to get on board because we're falling behind China. And the writers of this article, they see right through this. And many others point out that CBDCs would provide a digital alternative for the unbanked who rely on cash to make transactions. So... you know, the pitch here is that, oh, well, we're doing CBDC because a lot of people, they don't have bank accounts and we're here to help them. Okay. So they can participate in the economy. It's part of our inclusion push. But the article points out that that's rubbish, that the FDIC reports that among unbanked households in 2019, more than half, 56.2%, were not at all interested in having a bank account.
It's really interesting. Because, cash is going the other way. Because I think the fact that cash use is rising, and of course we're trying to encourage it with Cash Friday, is signs that people do not trust the government. And, to me, this is the poll that counts, the fact that cash is rising.
Well,
One of the reasons, John, I wanted to have this article on was American Institute for Economic Research is a really excellent group. They've got a lot of good financial planning tools, and we always recommend them. And this is the kind of, you know, this is a perfect example of them talking economic sense, which they do a lot. So
right.
It's a great website to know about, a great group to know about.
Yeah, it's a good article. It pokes holes in the CBDC official story. The article goes on. I'll just show you here. Another trope that's used for CBD, cash usage among criminals and tax cheats. We got to cut that out. And then the article points out, well, they said the public policy question really is whether the gain from reducing crime and tax, assuming you're really going to do that, warrants the loss of financial privacy. That's the real question, mm-hmm. not whether you're going to eliminate, you know, drug transactions. You're not.
Right.
You know, it's whether, you know, is whether the loss of your privacy is worth it. To your point about whether, you know, the cash use, let's just take a look at this. This is the graph of currency in circulation, and I'm going to blow it up a little bit so we can see it better. There we go. If you look here, this is the global right. financial crisis, 2008. See that bump in cash there?
Yep.
Big old bump in cash in the middle of the crisis.
Right.
Same thing in the pandemic.
Right.
Right? Look at that. As soon as the thing starts, cash goes through the roof.
And it's still rising.
And it's still rising.
Right.
Right. So.
Right.
Now, that's an interesting thing because the amount of cash in the system, currency in circulation, that's determined 100% by the Fed. So there's a bit of talking out of both sides of his mouth. I mean, on the one hand, they're denigrating cash. But on the other hand, it's the Fed that's driving up that graph. That it's the Fed that's pumping up cash during financial crises.
Right, but it shows me that there's demand for cash.
Oh, for sure there's huge demand for cash.
Right.
And in fact, it may be that demand for cash is what's buffeting the economy during downturns.
Could be. Absolutely,
right?
Could be.
Because there was rumors, and I don't know, I'm not saying they're credible one way or the other, I'm just noting their existence. There are rumors in the financial crisis that what was saving the system was drug trade. Cash transactions, the drug trade was sort of keeping the system afloat. Now, I don't know whether that's true or not.
I doubt it.
But that,
it's not big enough.
Yeah, but you can see, you know, you can see the bumps in cash.
Right.
I mean, why is the Fed doing that? If it hates cash so much,
well, you know,
why
Corbett, does it keep turning? Corbett is having Black Friday for basically black market transactions. So
I
I think there is nothing to stop communities from starting community currencies here. And if we really want to buffet the economy, that's what's got to happen. We've got to start decentralizing and liquefying money locally. Because if you look at the economic activity that's happening in every neighborhood, it's nowhere near what the demand is there for. So we're going to have to start issuing our own currencies if we want to have economies.
I 100% agree with that.
Right.
Yeah, we got to figure out a way to do that.
Right.
And I don't think it's going to be digital, you know, not if it's going to be online at all.
No.
You know, anyway, the last story in FedWatch, which is really a CBDC story, I guess, JP Morgan steps up as the first big U.S. bank offering broad retail crypto fund access. But in other words, they're offering to retail customers beyond those who are very wealthy. The funds that JP Morgan is offering, they offer investors indirect exposure to Bitcoin Cash, Ethereum, and I love this one, Ethereum Classic. Anyway, so JP Morgan has gotten on the crypto train, despite what Jamie Dimon said 2, 3, 4 years ago, that he hated crypto, it was never going anywhere.
Now,
what do you make of that?
Well, I think it... So a headline came in after we talked about this story that the new infrastructure bill has a provision that any $10,000 purchase or $10,000 or more into crypto needs to be reported, I'm presuming, in the currency transaction report system. And that's all part of institutionalizing this market. So you see multiple moves by the regulators to move this market into institutional control. And that's what they want to implement before the you know, before they're ready to launch the CBDC, because they need this market under institutional control when that happens. And by anybody who's accessible through the brokerage system, making it possible to buy this stuff through that system makes it much easier for many, many investors who are not willing to go through the custodian issues of buying digital currency when they haven't done it. So this makes it much more accessible to a whole world of investors who stayed out, but at the same time, it puts it totally under institutional control so that whatever the policies are, they can align with how the CBDC goes. And I think they're still making it up. They just know they need, you know, they need the central controllers and the owners of the central bank to control this market as well. And with China shutting down Bitcoin and now these various moves by Yellen and the banks, you know, I don't think what the crypto guys don't understand is the minute they want to have total control of this market, they can snap their fingers and do it.
Yeah. Right. That's an interesting theory. I gotta think about that. That's a lot to chew on.
Okay.
But I certainly agree with, from you can see the thrust of these stories, things are going toward institutional monetary control and institutional financial control.
Right.
That's, they're using these big money funds to do all
right.
this stuff.
Well, this, there is no doubt, you know, one of the problems over the last 10 years is you had many investors who were interested, but with no ETFs and no way of buying funds through the, you know, through the brokerage system. They couldn't play. And that was what the big debate about whether the SEC would approve the ETFs or not was, could you log into a discount brokerage and buy crypto through that vehicle? And this is what they're going. But if you look at how they do it with all the other things going on, it's going to be a very different picture.
Yeah. It certainly looks that way. I mean, the pivot by JP Morgan is very noteworthy to me.
Well, but let me ask you a question. If I came to you and I said, okay, John, no morals, no ethics. If we were just going to soak up as much money as possible to stop inflation, what would you do? And I dare say you would say, open up all the retail discount brokerage system to putting money in crypto, right? Because you're soaking up huge amounts of dollars and sucking up huge amounts of dollars. It basically goes into nothing, and so it doesn't drive up the price of real assets or farmland.
Yeah, but that's what I got to think about, because money doesn't get out of the banking system. It's a closed circuit. You can't just get rid of dollars. It's not that easy. Electronic dollars, they're trapped in a circuit. So even if you invest them
right
from A to B, they're just going from A's bank to B's bank. That's all that means. It doesn't mean they disappeared. Just means they're parked in a different
right.
parking lot.
But if $1 trillion buys Bitcoin instead of farmland, I dare say it's going to have an impact on the price of farmland.
But it's not sitting in Bitcoin. That's my thing. That money is with somebody.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
It's sitting in a bank somewhere.
Right.
Right. It doesn't. Right. The money doesn't go into a ground with the Bitcoin label over it. That's not how it works.
Right.
It's in the banking system.
Yes.
So that's why I say I gotta chew on this and figure what is their move here,
right?
But the
well,
big
what,
tell
what you need
is,
to think about is, does it change the multiplier on real assets?
Yeah, that's a good question. I don't know.
Okay.
Anyway, I'll chew on that one. So let's move on to we're gonna call it this one, space and pushback. And this is, we'll start with space and global turf wars here. As new NATO command becomes fully operational, top U.S. military officer issues warning over great power war. Okay? So this is interesting. First operational NATO headquarters in North America is in Norfolk, Virginia. And this is new. Then NATO also has, and already has, two other joint force commands. One's in the Netherlands, and one's in Italy, but now we've got one in Norfolk, Virginia, too. And Norfolk is a big naval
right,
port.
So I think Norfolk is the biggest port in the world. But
I think that's right, yeah.
But the reason this is big, so they started to work on this years ago, and it's only just in July that it went fully operational. And somebody put out scare headlines of, you know, NATO's taken over Norfolk, which is not true at all. But for you to have a NATO command that's operational in at Norfolk in the North America is a very big deal. Because if you look at what they're doing with NATO globally, they're trying to build it into a global military to replace, I think, the U.S. military. What was big on this, John, was they put out a headline that implied that the Atlantic sea lanes were a joint responsibility of NATO and the U.S. military. And what that is doing is saying the military operations behind the reserve currency are now a joint European-U.S. affair.
Right. So it's not so much replacing the U.S. military as it is subjugating the U.S. military to an alternative command.
Global control.
Namely, a global control.
And
yeah.
And what it does to me, if you look at what the headlines they were saying, this is a major shift of the dollar reserve currency to global hands.
Yeah.
Okay.
Right. And so I want to go back to the story because there's a red flag. There's a big red flag in this story. Okay. And I want to highlight it. This is they're quoting a general in this story, a top military brass in the story. In my view, the world is entering a period of potential instability as some nations, not all, but some, and clearly terrorist groups and perhaps some rogue actors are seeking to undermine and challenge the existing international order. And they seek also to weaken the system of cooperation and collective security, yada, yada. That's a load of nonsense. Okay, the terror, theme, the terror bogeyman, whenever that's trotted out, you know there's an alternative. There's a hidden agenda at
right.
work. Okay?
Right.
And so the hidden agenda, they tip their hand there by saying, oh, these terror people, these hidden terrorists, are out to upset the international order. We need to respond, and the response needs to be basically international.
Well, what I would say, and you saw this in the financial crisis, is the people centralizing power in both Europe and America, you know, are feeling the need to huddle together.
Yeah.
And they're feeling the need for global central control, you know, before it's too late and they have to share power. So I do feel that they feel threatened and are pushing for global central control.
Yeah. Okay. And then along those same lines, the next story, NATO and South Korea agree to step up global participation. Let me get this out of reader view here. NATO and South Korea agree to step up global cooperation. And so what do you have this? I don't have this highlighted. What is this story all about?
So I think the question before us is, are they going to globalize the military through NATO? Remember when Trump said NATO should be canceled? And in fact,
yes.
Before he said that, Lawrence Wilkerson, you know, on the Solari report said NATO's useless, it should be canceled. It looks to me from the headline on the Atlantic Command, when they were pulling out of Afghanistan, the announcement didn't come from the U.S., it came from the U.S., NATO, and the U.K. combined. So it looks to me like NATO is part of the train tracks to building a global government for the military side. And they've come out of the closet. When we said they're taking the gloves off, to me, everything they're doing with NATO is taking the gloves off and saying, you know, FASB 56 is done, we control all the money, now we're globalizing the military. And they're just doing it incrementally so that, you know, the guys in the trenches don't see it coming before the trap can be thrown.
Yeah. But it's coming for sure.
Oh, it's not coming. It's here.
Yeah. Well,
it's here.
It's just, it's certainly, it's arrived in the shores of Virginia. Yeah. Okay. Next story. This is just pure propaganda from The Economist. Unrest and economic underperformance haunt the emerging world. So get ready for a load of nonsense. At the start of the century, developing economies were a source of unbounded optimism and fierce ambition. But today, things are much different as South Africa has insurrection, Colombia has violent protests, and Tunisia has a constitutional crisis. And then the article just trots out all these things. Our excess mortality model, suggests that 8 to 16 million people have died in the pandemic, with central estimate at 14 million. So here, non-rich countries have 68% of the world's population, but 87% of its deaths. Okay, only 5% of those aged over 12 are fully vaccinated. So they trot out this notion. Emerging markets have less room to spend their way out of trouble. So right away, don't try to rely on your own currency, you emerging nations, you poor nations. That'll never work. You need to listen to us, because you're having big trouble over there, and we're going to offer the way to get you out of the trouble you're in. But don't print your own currency.
So here's what I would say, because I think there's a grain of truth in the story. You know, The Economist is good at always using the grain of truth.
Yes.
So the body, when it's in trauma, pulls the blood back from the toes and the fingers and moves it to the brain and the lungs and the heart. So the pandemic is a disaster capitalism op that pulled from the small guys and brought the sort of the blood in centrally. And that's wreaked havoc in the emerging markets. They've been harmed. You know, so when you shut down 34% of the U.S. economy, the small business, the supply lines feed back into all the emerging markets and really slaughter them. And so they've experienced this this further centralization, which draws resources out of their economy, and they've been wrecked by the op. And so, yeah. And so, you know, The Economist is the pot calling the kettle black, because they're trying to blame what happens on them. So the people drawing the resources back and wrecking havoc in the emerging markets are now blaming the emerging markets for somehow being poorly managed.
Yeah.
Right.
Right. So just rely on us, the people who cause these problems. We're gonna provide the solution.
Right.
And by the way, this is from The Economist. This is, you know, I used to subscribe to this magazine.
Right.
Starting when I was in high school, and I don't think this is a leader. It's at the front part of that magazine, sort of an opinion piece. They have five or six opinion pieces to start off that magazine. I don't think I've ever read an Economist leader. They're really long too. Right. I don't think I've ever read one without asking myself, well, why am I reading this? Where is this heading? You know, and this is another, this is giving me flashbacks.
So I've subscribed to The Economist since Wall Street, and I still do, because they are the single best place to read the spin. If you want to understand the lead economics coup spin,
yeah,
they're the ones who are doing it. And it's too bad, because they used to have some fantastic original research, and
yes.
I miss that.
Right. They published an annual edition. You know, this is really before computers. So, you know, like I was in high school and college, that before the internet, where you'd have just tons of data
right
at your fingertips.
Right.
It was amazing.
Right.
And I don't know if they still do that, but the leaders, oh my God, they're unreadable. Anyway, they go on and on and on with this story. Research suggests protests suppress the economy. So there we go. Don't protest. That's not good for
people. People unhappy about food.
You know, don't protest. Right. That's the wrong thing to do, okay? Protests suppress the economy, which just spirals and leads to further discontent. Many people are unvaccinated well into 2022.
We got to get to pushback, because this is too depressing even for me.
We got to get vaccinated. And by the way, here we go. Turkey's notion that raising interest rate causes inflation has been disastrous, okay? Venezuela's pursuit of socialism has been ruinous, probably meaning don't elect people who actually care for you. Banning foreign firms from adding customers, as India has just done with MasterCard, is self-defeating. So here's what you need to do, you poor people. Stay open to trade, compete in global markets, and invest in infrastructure and education. Unbelievable.
It is unbelievable.
It is just what a load. Anyway, next story in global turf wars, it's from Wall Street on Parade. Communist Party just wiped out a whole industry in China.
This is really important, because after Didi went public, China sort of changed the regulation and they dropped 10% overnight. Now they're thinking about going private. But now China has changed the regulations related to private educational companies. The stock, in fact, we have a chart that we'll go through when we get to the charts. New Oriental, which is ticker EDU, which is a stock I've followed for many, many years, dropped over 80%, literally overnight. And so,
wow.
Yeah. So we're watching a situation where, certainly in China, regulators are willing to literally wipe out an industry, you know, publicly traded industries overnight. It's shocking.
Yeah.
And I think it's very, very important, you know, as an investor, that you realize we're in a world where these kinds of things can happen. I mean, imagine if you're an airline that doesn't want to do vaccine mandates. You could be wiped out and shut down in a month.
Right. So the industry that the Martins are talking about in this article is private education market. And a sampling of carnage is reflected in the chart above. Okay.
I've got a chart. When we get to charts, we'll go through the charts. Okay. I've got a chart for it.
So they say shares of these companies have all lost nearly all of their market value since April. Regulations issued over the weekend by China's Ministry of Education now bar these private tutoring and online education platforms from making profits from raising capital and from being listed on a stock exchange.
One of my questions, John, are the Chinese moving to tear apart the two capital markets so that, you know, if companies go public in the West or through London or New York, you know, they're going to be subject to this treatment. So it's basically, you know, you come home, you raise capital in our capital markets. So there's a real ripping of the fabric between the two markets. It's my concern.
Yeah. That's the really big point, is that you know, this could happen overnight to any number of companies.
Right.
I mean, it's not going to happen to IBM, right? But if smaller companies, yeah, you could. I mean, just as we saw the interference from, you know, big asset management firms, you're seeing it also coming from China as well.
And I'm grossly oversimplifying. If there's no rule of law and the Beck brothers are free to shake down a $2 billion corporation, I mean, this is the problem with no rule of law. Financial liquidity depends on the rule of law. You cannot have financial liquidity based on the rule of man. And these guys are on the move to destroy all liquidity.
Yeah. Right. I mean, money is a legal instrument.
Right.
You know, so no law, you got a problem on your hands.
Yep.
And you're seeing it here.
That's what I said in 1998. And I've been saying it every year since. So
big problems. The next article is really on global turf wars, and this involves Taiwan. Sort of, they state the obvious here. No chance U.S. could stop Chinese invasion of Taiwan, military expert says. Expert should be in quotation marks here, as you'll see why in a minute.
Right.
Veteran Chinese commentator Du Wenlong spoke confidently about the People's Liberation Army's amphibious capabilities on Tuesday, amid a large exercise conducted 135 nautical miles north of Democratic Taiwan. And he says, this is who, quote, this is the expert, so-called expert. Before U.S. forces arrive, we will have completed all our combat tasks. They will have no chance to intervene in a Taiwan Strait conflict. So that's why, I mean, he's not an expert. He's just a spokesman for the PLA. He even refers to what's going on. Is there no chance they could stop us, right? I thought you were an expert. But anyway, the notion here is that China can take over Taiwan and the U.S. can't do a damn thing about it.
Well, so I don't believe that that is the case. But if it is, it won't be long till China takes over Taiwan, and then you're going to see a complete flip in the South China Sea to Chinese control of the sea lanes, which means all the countries along the perimeter and the rim and who trade through the South China Sea are going to have to switch from recognizing the U.S. as hegemon to China. And when I tell you, that is going to be one of the biggest dramatic shifts in the dollar system yet. And I would point out, we just saw this yesterday, the Japanese are now significantly shedding their treasury position.
Yeah.
Right.
That's big.
That's very big.
Let me ask you this. What do you put the odds of China taking over Taiwan in the next year?
60%.
No.
Yes. And I'll tell you why.
Mike, take the under on that.
You'll probably
No, I'm just saying.
But maybe, so I would say in the next 5 years is 80%. So,
wow.
And I'll tell you why. I think the people who want to globalize NATO have made a deal to do that. And they made that deal coming into Wuhan. So I think that deal's already been cut.
Wow. And, you know, China does have a way of acting in the interests of large financial institutions, I've noticed more and more.
Right. So I don't think China's acting as a free player. I think China's acting as part of a global group. And the deal they've made is if China supports everything they want to do in terms of globalizing the dollar system, you know, they get Hong Kong and Taiwan. I think they've already cut that deal.
Wow. You know,
I could be totally wrong. I'm speaking just from intuition. It's what it smells and feels like to me.
You know, I kind of agree because, like I say, China, I notice more and more, China acts in the interest, ultimately, of the, and I don't mean companies like JP Morgan Chase. I mean the people who really own the own the monetary system. China's like a tool of those people.
Right.
So it wouldn't surprise me. I mean, it would surprise me because I hadn't thought of it. But when I think about it, it's like, why didn't I think of that before?
Mr. Global, China is playing ball with Mr. Global here.
I agree. Yeah, I got to.
Well, but there's something else. Wonder. If you go back to when globalization started, what we did, what the financial coup was, we sucked a huge amount of money out of the United States and the G7, and we reinvested in a variety of places. One of them was clearly China and Asia. And who had the lead Chinese fund when that happened? It was Carlyle, David Rubenstein. He's chairman of the Council on Foreign Relations. They put huge money in China, and they have continued to put huge money in China. They have continued to transfer huge amounts of intellectual capital to China. They have continued to make big bets on China and the Chinese space program. I don't see any change in that whole movement by them. And I think their vision is we want to become a multiplanetary civilization, and we need the engineering capacity and operational capacity of China and India and Asia to do that. I think this is a very long-term plan, and I haven't seen that plan change in really any deep fundamental way.
Yeah. Bam.
You know, look at the ads for the Chinese military. They're not trying to turn them into women.
No, I know.
Right.
Exactly. Neither is Russia.
Right.
Right. That's only the U.S. That's diluting the brand. You know, no one else is diluting the brand. It's us.
Well, but I think we have to face facts. If you have a society where 74 to 80% of your children are chronically diseased, you have no future.
Right.
And, you know, and if you look at what China's doing with their young people, et cetera, you know, they don't appear. For some reason, my Zoom disappeared here.
You're coming. I can see you.
You can see me? Okay, good.
Yeah, you're transmitting.
So, you know, I think it's time to face the fact that somebody is trying to take the United States down and bring up China. And I don't see anything to suggest that that has changed.
Yeah, right. That's kind of how these stories, the trend line of these stories looks.
Right.
I would agree.
Right.
Yeah. Okay, happier topic, pushback. let's try to hit a couple of these sort of quickly. But the first one's a TMZ sports story. So it's going to be quick because their headlines are huge. Minnesota Vikings coach refuses COVID vaccine, loses job.
Wow.
Yay. Yeah.
Right.
An NFL coach standing up. Isn't that great?
He's a hero.
I love that.
He's a hero.
Because, you know, most people, they get us around the NFL, like, oh, the NFL, that's like the holy grail. That's the best thing in the world. Why would you ever give that up? He says, nope, not having the vaccine. Next big headline story is, good luck with this one. Rand Paul sends official criminal referral on Anthony Fauci to the DOJ. You have to laugh.
Well, you know, it's amazing. The day after he did this, suddenly there was enormous amounts of pushback from the other team. It's kind of the, you know, it was 3 days of the gloves are off again and again and again. This, I think Paul upset somebody with this one.
Yeah, he did. But I'm telling you, the DOJ, I mean, that's not going anywhere. Forget it.
Well, except for one thing, you know, I'll just take the long shot on that. If I was the establishment, I might throw Fauci to the wolves just to make myself look credible.
I'll take the under on that one.
Okay.
Too.
Okay, you'll probably win. It's a long shot.
Because Fauci's been a tool since at least as early as AIDS.
Yeah, I know, but they love to cycle people, throw some under the bus. Oh, we didn't realize it was that bad. He went too far.
I think that
they do it all the time.
Sends the wrong signal, I think, to the to the people they need.
Yes.
To the puppets.
I agree.
The head puppets would find that very scary.
Yes, I agree.
Like, hey, they could chop my head off too. The next story, this is a good one. Hydroxychloroquine doctor sues CNN Anderson Cooper for $100 million. CNN published a series of statements about Dr. Emanuel that injured her reputation and exposed her to public hatred, contempt, ridicule, and financial industry. Now, here's where the story gets interesting, because if this lawsuit goes forward, there are certain things that have to be litigated and resolved during the litigation, and this is one of them. The suit contends that hydroxychloroquine is, quote, entirely effective, end quote, in the treatment of COVID. The doctor says that CNN, in discrediting the drug, quote, effectively caused the deaths of hundreds of thousands whose lives would have been spared if they had been treated early with HCQ. That, if you're the powers that be, has got to be a scary lawsuit.
Right, particularly
for the reason I say.
You know, Skidmore is out there with a study saying 180 to 200,000 people killed by withholding hydroxychloroquine.
Yeah.
Yep.
Right. Okay. I now want to go to, I wanted to put together a series of videos. Okay. And I put them together of protests around the world. Okay.
Okay.
And these are protests against the vaccine, protests against mandatory vaccines, and protests against vaccine passports.
Right. I'll tell you something. The French, they understand the danger of the passports. Mike Eden gives a great presentation on the danger of the passports in the Doctors for COVID Ethics Symposium. These passports are the end of human liberty in the West. Naomi Wolf is exactly right.
Right. So the protests are going on around the world. I'm going to unplug my headphones so we can hear it. I've never presented videos this way, but we're going to try it. Okay, so let's get it rolling. Here we go. We're starting in Paris, okay? Look at the camera shot here. Okay, look at that. Look how many people
are
there. You see that?
It's just huge. And it was all over France, too. It wasn't just Paris.
That's a lot of people.
Yep.
So that's in Paris. Now we're going to go to London. Thing I like about this London one is some of the signs, and some of them come up kind of quick, but see a sign Magna Carta on the right there?
Yep.
99% obviously Occupy Wall Street. Don't tread on me. See that one?
Yep.
5G sign. You know. Anyway, that's London. Protests also in Leeds, which I find kind of interesting. Because Leeds is, it's sort of an industrial area, I believe. But look at this, protests are going on here. And I'm going to scrub through this one because the interesting shot isn't there. The interesting shot is here. Again, there's a lot of people at this protest. You see that?
There are a lot of people. It was all over Europe, is my impression.
Huh?
Now,
and then we have protests.
If we could just get them all to move their bank deposits, we'd be doing good.
Yeah, right. Right. Get them out of HSBC there. Next protest, we got in Germany. There's a couple in Germany. Again, a ton of people. Look at that.
It's a lot.
And a lot of police in all these videos.
That's why when you read the polls from the propaganda guys, I just don't believe a word of them, because not what we're seeing here and not what I'm hearing.
Right. So anyway, let's go to another one in Germany. This one's great because I need to preface this by saying the police are trying to form a line to block people from going in certain areas. And that's sort of the backdrop to this. And then I'll just fast forward and tell you the police fail in their mission.
Right.
So here we go. You can see they're kind of getting rough with people. A couple of people squib through. And then the sluice gates come up. Look at the cops getting there. It's like, well, forget it. As the Germans rally and get to look at it. Here we go.
It's too many.
The Germans.
It's too many people.
Yeah, way too many people. Okay. So that's in Germany. Let's move on. This is Sydney, and this is really a blockage, more than anything else. Sydney, Australia, which is, you know, they have severe lockdowns there, right?
The lockdowns in Sydney are some of the worst in the world, and my heart just goes out to everybody.
Yeah,
in
even they're standing up. This next one's in Nice, France.
Yeah, the and Riviera.
Again, this one's,
yeah, they're protesting. That's the Riviera. They're protesting on the Riviera. Yeah.
Yeah, and but again, look at the number of people here. This is just amazing.
The French were out in full force. Wow, look at that. Wow.
Okay, and then finally we come back to Paris, where they're getting into it with the police, who seem to have an advantage at first, but then the Parisians turn the tide against the cops.
My heart goes out to the police because I don't think the police are on board for any of this. I really don't.
And then the police, you know, they're starting to back up because they're getting pelted and they're wildly outnumbered. And then the water cannons come out.
Yeah.
So that is really, that's kind of it for protests around the world.
Well, what I just say to all the protesters, use cash on Friday.
Yeah.
Right. So I did want to bring something up, and we'll talk about it more, but a very important dear ally of the Soleri Report and of me personally died Monday before last in Australia, Jason Bowden-Smith. He'd been struggling for a long time with cancer, and it finally got the better of him. And the family is planning a funeral for August 11th. And as soon as we are through that period, I'm going to announce a public celebration of his life. We're collecting photos and stories at jason.soleri.com. If you have a photo or a story you want to share about Jason and what he meant to you, please send it to customerservice@soleri.com, or you can send it to askcatherine@soleri.com. And as soon as we're through the funeral on August 11th, then I'll announce a celebration. It's going to be quite a big production because he was, he was one of my best allies. It never occurred to me, because he was much younger than I am, it never occurred to me that I would live on this planet without him. And in fact, when he left, he told one of our subscribers, was with him, one wonderful subscriber you'll be hearing more from. But he said, you know, I'm going to be working to help communities in Soleri from the other side. So stay tuned, because I'll plug back in spiritually. Anyway, so we're going to, well, I don't want to give it away. So get ready for a major celebration of one of the finest people I've ever known. He was...
Wow.
I wish you could have known him. You would have absolutely loved him, John. Anyway, so we're celebrating Jason Bowden-Smith. We did have a couple charts that I wanted to dive into quickly.
Yep. Okay.
We can do this very, very quickly.
Here we go.
So the first one is we're looking at the, I got to look way up to the screen.
Large cap index, S&P 500. And then the one, VGK, FXI, and TLT.
Yeah, so at the very top, you're looking at the S&P and the European stock market. So you're, you know, not S&P still ahead. It's always a miracle how that happens, but the European stock market doing well. Bonds, of course, are not the place to be, and that's what you see. And the what is traded off with all the regulatory changes and games is FXI. So the Chinese are tremendously lagging behind. And part of it is their own regulatory actions. So Europe and the U.S. doing okay, China really sort of in the doldrums. And I just think the bloom is off the rose, as we've said many times, in the long-term bond markets. But bonds clearly doing, you know, staying ahead of the Chinese equities. So go to the next one. So I think this is the one with EDU, right? I
can hardly see. Yeah, this is FXI in blue and EDU in red.
Right. So we see the S&P doing well, FXI down. Is the top one S&P?
Yes.
And then the bottom one is EDU, which is New Oriental, the largest private educational company. And I cannot tell you what a shock it is to an investor to wake up and see a stock in this short a period of time dive 80%.
That's down 88%. S&P is up 17%.
Right.
And then FXI is down 11%.
Right. So as I said, you know, my question is, are we trying to tear the Asian and the U.S. stock market apart? We'll see.
Yeah.
And then the next one, of course, is what we say all along, but I like to touch base, and that is the inflation story as strong as ever.
Right.
So this is the chart from FinViz that shows all the different commodities. And of course, what you see is the
dark green bands is S&P 500. That's the top dark green band, it up at 17%. And then after that, you can see the break, a very sharp break from 17% to 24%, and that's oats. And so on up from oats, you have copper, 26%, all the way up to gasoline, RBOB at 62%.
Right.
Most of those are energy, but you also in there, you have coffee and canola.
Right. And that's important because, you know, if you look at, so for example, manufacturing, the biggest component is not labor, it's energy. So we're talking about the kind of rises, whether in food or energy prices, that translates throughout the economy into everything. So the inflation story continues to go very, very strong.
Yeah.
Right.
The email we were looking at was a email that you had gotten from a subscriber, and I redacted it just to conceal identities. But it was a email from a subscriber about shipments from Amazon.
Right.
And it's basically, the person says, "Dear Catherine, a chill went up my spine when I heard your latest Ask Catherine show, where another subscriber talked about a problem they've had with unordered Amazon packages arriving." And they was basically saying, all these packages that are arriving, I've had the same thing. And they're basically skin and hair products and face masks. And one was a golf ball sized thing meant to strengthen one's jaw. The common denominator of all these products was that they would be used on the body. So, you know, what's up is the same thing going on. The subscriber wants to know with other subscribers.
Right. So we've gotten several of these, and I published an article. It's in the news, trends, and stories category. The explanation appears to be that people who want to get reviews to help bolster their product are shipping things out for free as a marketing effort. Which may be true, but I also think there are real security and safety issues here. So if you get a package from Amazon that you didn't order, my strong advice is do not touch it, do not open it, ship it back. And I just think there are real serious security and safety issues here. So I would, you know, some people have said, well, we opened it, we can keep it. No, you don't want it.
Right.
It's
not worth it.
Right.
Right.
I mean, if in a world where it's conceivable we're struggling with really serious biowarfare, you don't want bioproducts from strangers and people and companies you don't know. I just think there are real security issues here. So I would, you know, it's called just right on the package, return to sender and ship it back.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. I think that's really good advice. That's certainly what I would do. Yeah.
Okay. Well, I feel like we've been a little bit more depressing than normal, but I have to say I was very inspired by the Doctors for COVID Ethics experience.
And that was amazing.
It was amazing. So many high quality people coming together. And that's the energy I feel, because the people instituting tyranny, they have to do what they do. You know, they're going to get worse, but I'm seeing people all around the world, saying, okay, we get this. It's not a pandemic. This is a tyranny problem. And the only thing we have, you know, we don't have to fear the magic virus. We don't have to fear fear. We have to fear tyranny, and that's what we're going to do. And if you look at all the things we can do in our daily lives, you know, whether it's shifting our money, shifting our time, pulling out of institutions, issuing new community currencies, there's thousands of things we can do once we realize it's time to go build something else.
Right. And lest there be any confusion, my inclusions on that panel of doctors for COVID ethics was as the direct result of a request by one Catherine Austin Fitz. So thank you, Catherine, for bringing me to the attention of some wonderful people.
It was great. I never thought I could see anybody explain central banking in 20 minutes, but you did it.
I tried. I tried really hard. That was the first time I'd done a live presentation using OBS Studio to switch in Zoom from the camera on me to the camera on slides, basically.
It was great.
Yeah, that was great.
Okay, ladies and gentlemen, have a great week. Push back and remember, cash on Friday.
Cash on Fridays. You got it. All right, Catherine.
Thanks.
We will see you next week.
Bye.
Bye.